morning. Hawaii's last sugar plantation will close at the end of the year. Today, ANB's CEO Chris Benjamin joins us with the status of former and soon-to-be former AC&S employees, plus the plans for the land and competition for water. And we hear from a would-be teacher who questions just how serious the DOE is about hiring qualified teachers. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Apprentice navigator Austin Kino is keeping the skills of Hawaii's ancestral deep-sea voyaging and non-instrument navigation techniques alive. And Kahulu Maluo, Cultural Programs Director for the Maui Arts and Cultural Center, looks ahead to a panel discussion entitled Demystifying the Kuahu.
That's the conversation for Thursday, August 18th. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Getting another perspective on the teacher shortage this morning.
Well, you know how we always say one conversation usually begets another one? Well, this in fact flowed from a conversation earlier this week.
Yeah, this is a good example.
Now, you might remember that we spoke with Hawaii State Teachers Association President Corey Rosenley about the proposal to give DOE teachers, or rather leaders, a raise. In our conversation, he talked about the hundreds of classrooms without a teacher or without a qualified one to teach in a subject for which they were assigned. Afterward, we heard from a woman who questioned how earnest the DOE really was in hiring qualified teachers. She was one with a valid out-of-state teacher certificate good through July 2019. It lists her certification in six areas: biology, English, English for speakers of other languages, elementary education K-6, physical education and reading. Plus, she has a master's degree. She told us she wasn't hired. Well, Patty Wells joins us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you for being willing to come in and talk about this.
Thank you.
We have often heard how many teachers we need to fulfill every year's needs. And when we talk about having these job fairs where, you know, teachers or people who might be able to teach in classrooms are to come out, you actually answered one of those on the 5th of this month, and you went to a job fair. When you presented all of your credentials, what were you told?
I was told because I was an out-of-state teacher with a valid out-of-state teacher's license, I was placed on what was called the second tier of hiring candidates.
And what did that mean?
It meant that I didn't get any calls. I interviewed last year with the Department of Education, presented all my credentials, and was told that I would be placed on a list of available teachers, and that was November of 2015, and I never got a call.
What about any substitute work?
No substitute work. I was told I would have to go door to door to the schools around the area to become a substitute there and present my credentials that way and fill out another application that was different from the actual online teacher application.
And that there was no central base from which substitutes would be pulled?
From what I understand, no.
So where does this leave you now in wanting to explore this further? You've been a teacher for a lot of years. You've taught in Florida. You've taught in American Samoa. Now you're in Hawaii, and you would have liked to have been teaching here, but now you seem to be one of those statistics of teachers who are outplacing because they can't get a job.
Because of the online hiring practices here, I was basically shut out from what I would have considered opportunities. Even if they needed a substitute in a classroom temporarily, I would have been fine with that. If the DOE was looking for someone in a particular field, I could have filled the need in so many different areas, but I never got the call. And I was on the list available to teach anywhere in the island. I was focusing on Honolulu because I live here, as opposed to maybe teaching at a high school in the North Shore, but I still was available. But because I didn't have the Hawaii teacher's license, but I was still told that I was good for 3 years here with my Florida teaching license because it's still active.
Who told you that?
I was told this by a high school administrator who interviewed me. I got two interviews in spring of this year for positions and still wasn't hired.
At this point, have you talked to the DOE at all to find out whether there are other things afoot? I mean, you've told us you don't have skeletons in your closet. There aren't reasons that you shouldn't be hired except for, you know, maybe you think you're perhaps a little, you know, older, you're not coming out of school, but you have all these qualifications and you have a lot of teaching years ahead of you potentially. Have you talked to them at all about anything that they might have shed some light on this?
The only stumbling block I can see is their requirement that I take their teacher exam, the praxis, and get a license that way. And I couldn't get anyone to answer the question that my Florida license could be, you know, deemed as valid as a Hawaii state license, as the Hawaii state exam, because I took the Florida teacher's exam, which would be the equivalent of the praxis. And since I passed it there, I don't know why I would have to, you know, why wouldn't there be an equivalency that will accept you because you still have a current teaching license? It's not like my license has expired and I'd need to take it to re-enter the field. I was still an active teacher. I could still be a teacher. I'm active. I'm not like on the inactive list, and I don't see why I would need to take the praxis here. And no one could tell me why I would need to and why my valid teaching certificate was not good here or was not good enough to be on the top tier with all my certifications in so many fields.
That brings up two questions. One, would you be willing to take the praxis to be able to get a job in teaching, or have you just shut that down entirely because you're annoyed?
I'm very disappointed, and I, as a teacher, as a longtime teacher, part of me is like, why should I have to? Why can't y'all accept my teaching certificate? Why isn't it valid here? I mean, if they needed me to do it, if it was like an absolute mandatory, had to do it, but why couldn't I still be a substitute? I'm still a perfectly good substitute in a classroom where there is not a certified teacher in the subject area.
Which is some of what brought you to us in the first place when you heard Corey Rosenlee say that, you know, teachers, non-Spanish speaking teachers are being hired to teach Spanish, but you in fact have six areas in which you could be teaching, and now it seems as if that teaching is going to, you know, lose you from the profession to go into another one. Is there anything that would bring you back into teaching short of having to capitulate and take the praxis?
Short of that, I don't see anything really luring me back into it, but it was a field that I loved. I enjoyed doing it. I'm sorry to leave it. But I see this as a major stumbling block, and I don't see why there can't be some sort of method whereby they could accept me conditionally and give me maybe a year to teach in a classroom before I took the praxis, give me some time to, you know, study their material so that I could take it and pass it. But I don't see why I couldn't be in a classroom now as a teacher, certified teacher in so many areas. Why couldn't I be in there now just to say temporary, you know, just put me in temporarily until I pass it?
In part, that brings up the second question, too, that if we are so desperate for teachers who are qualified to teach, particularly in the areas that you're talking about, you know, from biology to English to elementary education, K-6, phys ed, reading, all of that, and that you have a master's to boot, why that's not enough to at least get a foot in the door?
That is the question for the ages. I've got two master's degrees. I'm certified. Personal training, American College of Sports Medicine. I still can't even get a PE job. I don't know what the stumbling block is.
Well, we called the DOE to ask them, you know, if somebody had the qualification that you do and were told they were, you know, second tier, if the only issue was not taking the praxis. But they didn't really want to talk to us about anything without having us divulge, you know, who you were and more information about you, which we were just not going to do. If you wish to do that, which you've clearly done by being on the program today, that's up to you. But we still have this question about if there are other people like you and we need teachers so badly, why aren't people like you being hired? I guess we're going to have to wait and see if we can get an answer from the DOE about that one. But we wish you all good luck as you move into a completely different area of your life. And thank you very much for being willing to talk to us.
Thank you, Fo.
Patty Wells has a master's in elementary education from Florida Atlantic University. She taught middle and high school in Florida from 1998 to 2014, and she was teaching in community college in American Samoa in 2015. She would have liked to have been teaching in Hawaii this year. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15. Coming up, the Polynesian Navigator's Apprentice. But first, your backyard quiz.
For today's backyard, we went looking through some photo negatives by a photographer who is best known for his dramatic black and white images. Our mystery shutterbug spent most of his time shooting the American West, particularly Yosemite National Park, but traveled to Hawaii in the 40s and 50s to photograph the islands and its people. Some of his notable photographs include Monolith, Moonrise, and In the Rainforest. His works are groundbreaking and influential and have stood the test of time. Do you know which photographer we've focused our Leica on today? We'll have the answer later in the show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Aloha, I'm Christopher G. from Mission L. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on our show on facebook.com/HIConversation.
Wayfinders, and that's the way it has been taught for centuries, through apprenticeship, a day-to-day immersion, learning by doing. Austin Kino is an apprentice navigator with a voyage aboard the Hokulea behind him, and true to the master and apprentice tradition, he's passing his skills along to younger people. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Austin.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Is there a quick and dirty way to learn this, or do you have to just really be an apprentice and spend some time?
Yeah, you just got to kind of like anything. That was really appropriate, you know, in a Hawaiian style, learning by doing, makahana ka ike. And I think that's pretty much the only approach to go about it.
It just wouldn't work if you simplified it or dumbed it down, would it?
Yeah, and you know, this school of navigation we're learning now and trying to condense in our, even from when I was in high school, but it's been really an art that individuals would spend their lifetime learning.
Yeah. And which and really what Mao passed along to Nainoa Thompson is essentially what's been now passed along to you, right?
Right. When Nainoa, who's my teacher, the president of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, went to Mao Pialuk, who's from Satawal, and asked him to teach navigation, he said, send me your children, which essentially meant you're too old to learn with enough time to all the skills you need to
He's
be a
already,
proficient navigator, yeah.
It was already too late in his life, huh?
Right, right. But the exceptional thing, which is a really good opportunity now, is Nainoa was able to take the tradition of Mao had and through traditional navigation, combine it with his background of math and science, so I was able to understand it with, you know, modern navigational techniques and compasses. And so now we can teach it and scale it to any math and science lesson in a classroom, or we can sit down at the beach with students and kind of a variety of options to continue to teach it. At least we have this ability to teach it and keep it flourishing throughout Hawaii and Polynesia.
So actually integrating contemporary math and science techniques actually enhances it, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the greatest goals of Polynesian Voyaging Society since it started in 1975 is to just not only prove traditional Polynesian voyaging was the correct theory that they skillfully navigated as opposed to the drift theory.
Yeah.
But they wanted to make it so it's always survives in Hawaii. And now seeing little kids come to the canoe and say they've been learning it in school, or I'll attend a math class and they're telling me how they've broken down our star compass in one of their lessons, learning about angles. It's amazing to see how far we've come and how many different crossovers there are to learning something that would have just been taught on the beach with sand and stones previously.
And yet it sort of enhances the value of both kinds of learning, doesn't it? I mean, shows how compatible they are, but also that they feed into each other.
Yeah, it's been really cool, too, for the kids that, you know, like myself, who maybe struggled in a classroom, got confused by math. We'll take them out. I've had the ability to take some of those kids out on the canoe and seeing how their spatial awareness, and that's their strength on the boat. And the kids that maybe were the really good at sail planning on the land are kind of, everyone's able to kind of find something that suits their strengths with this new style of teaching.
So were you, when you were a young kid, you were not the kind of kid who was naturally inclined toward math and science, huh?
No, actually, when we first started learning how to chart or map, you know, very classroom lessons, even in high school, I was kind of like the last one, quiet, didn't really say anything. And my strength has always been, once we got on the water and I've grown up, you know, steering smaller canoes, six-man canoes, and the same difficulty that I might have had with a math problem, one of my classmates might have had understanding how to make small corrections in the water as to oversteer. So it's just, we've all been able to kind of balance out one another in our group, and it's really strengthened this whole new next generation of apprentice navigators that I think are coming up.
Yeah, the problem with, I think, people's understanding of traditional modes of learning is that they think it's sort of less methodical, that is kind of based on instinct rather than very serious method. And there's obviously a great deal of learning and method that went into Polynesian navigation, yeah?
Yeah, extremely. If there's one thing that, you know, especially with this worldwide voyage and taking the canoe to a global arena and a global audience outside of Polynesia, is to just, it's been amazing to remind people that Polynesians were scientists, that they were mathematicians of their day, that they were the astronauts of our ancestors. And that, yeah, although something, you know, you just see a guy looking, staring, maybe squinting his eyes out into the sunset, and you think it's all feel. I mean, there's a lot of science that's going on behind not only the colors and what he's noticing and what that's telling him about forecasting weather, but when he's looking at the variety of swell directions coming to the boat and when to make that decision, it's as calculated as you would to watch a weather report before undertaking on a Trans-Pacific sail. So it's been a really, really amazing thing to see Polynesians represented now on a global stage, this worldwide voyage.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you have to train yourself to a whole new way of seeing in terms of looking at, as you say, looking at the direction of swells, things like that?
Yeah, a little bit. It's trial and error. It's time on the ocean, and we are by no means near where our teachers are, and our teachers will say that they are adolescents compared to where their teachers were as far as those who spent their lifetime. But, you know, you start to build up confidence. So the first time we had to sail, when we couldn't see another island, we were just trying to find Nihoa. It's a northwestern Hawaiian island, mm-hmm. about a day sail away from Hawaii. And so that first time, you're actually don't have an island to sight and reference, mm-hmm. and you kind of have to rely and give the steersman command just by looking at an open ocean swell without having like a backup.
Uh-huh.
It's scary and it's unnerving. And then you do that for a day and 2 days, and then you find your destination that you plotted on a map ahead of time. And the next time you get on the boat, the next voyage, you just have a little bit more confidence. You know, your feet are a little bit more calculated, because that's how navigators can feel the swell. As you know, they say they're always barefoot on the deck, and just be a little more attuned. But I think it's the more times you do it, yeah, learning by doing is pretty much the only way we've been able to succeed.
So actually, with your bare feet on the deck, you feel the motion of the ocean, and that tells you?
Right, exactly. I mean, everyone asks, you know, if you don't, we can teach people, and you can learn how to use a fixed celestial object, the rising sun, a rising moon, a star at night, to find a bearing. But mm-hmm. when all those things disappear, all you have is the swell of the ocean, and when you can't see it, it's the feeling that it creates on the canoe. So the best example I can give is if, you know, you're sailing directly at a sun that's rising, and you know that direction is east in the morning. If the wave is coming right at you, you can feel what the hull is doing going over the wave. And then once you lose the sun, as long as you maintain that throughout the day, you can still relatively be holding the same bearing. But if all of a sudden you feel the boat violently rocking side to side, mm-hmm. you know that you've turned maybe like, say, like a 90-degree angle to that original direction. So that feeling of the wave under and what it causes the canoe to do is probably the hardest thing to recognize. And they said that Mao, who's the original teacher of us all, could be essentially in the hull without the ability of sight and sleeping, and feel when there was adjustments being made and when the crew had gone off course, just from the little sound of the water against the hull and the way that the canoe is moving. So we don't necessarily always navigate bare feet, especially when it's cold, but that's just kind of an expression to say that you're using really everything about you spatially to feel, instead of not just when you just can't see, you know.
It must have taught you a lot about just how to concentrate in general, because this doesn't sound like the kind of activity where your mind could wander.
Yeah, it has. And I think it's a really special opportunity to feel that mindset. And the thing I love about sailing is it puts me in that mental space of my ancestors. And if you had a hard time focusing before, once they put you on the deck and say that, look at your 15 crew members around you, and if you're the navigator, you're the father, you're responsible for getting them there safely, your concentration fills in, and your awareness all of a sudden, you know, it's an amazing human experience to see the natural ability I think we all have inside of us.
Yeah.
But unless you kind of hone it and are forced sometimes to channel it, we never get to see it on land when we're shown how to go and find our way so easily through all the tools we have today.
Awesome. It's got to be a great experience for you. Thanks so much for coming.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Apprentice Navigator Austin Kino will be the guest speaker at the Study Hall on Tuesday, September 6th at 6:30. It's a free event at the Modern Honolulu, part of the hotel's ongoing Study Hall lecture series.
Millions of stars up in the sky, looking up, they all make us high. Star of gladness,
you're the happy star.
Oh, who they are, star of gladness.
Here's a simple fact. It costs $9.15 to run Hawaii Public Radio's statewide network every minute of every day. That comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand balancing a budget, and we're infinitely grateful for their support. Steve Marquis of Hulualoa, Lisa Yoshikawa of Wailuku, and Justin Higgins of Honolulu. If HPR adds quality to your life, please become a member at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's open every minute of every day, and thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose employees and their ohana volunteer with local charities, including the American Heart Association's Heart Walk and the International Coastal Cleanup. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
As we learned yesterday, there are now 206 cases of hepatitis A in Hawaii. Meanwhile, one of the cases has brought a case of his own. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a look at the first lawsuit. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Was this inevitable that somebody would sue?
Well, it certainly didn't take very long, did it? I mean, it was just the other day that the Department of Health identified as the likely culprit for the outbreak these imported frozen scallops, the likely source of hepatitis A. And of course, Genki Sushi was ordered by the health department to shut down 11 of its stores on Oahu and Kauai, but not Maui and the Big Island. I should get that point across. So this lawsuit is coming from an Oahu man He's suing Genki as well as Koha Foods. That's the frozen food wholesaler. He's alleging a negligence in serving him.
Negligence in serving him? What about when he went to the hospital?
Well, it was not a pretty sight, according to the lawsuit. He, by the way, the claimant, was among the first people diagnosed with Hep A. He said he was experiencing fatigue and nausea. So then he went to Kaiser, where it was discovered he had an inflamed liver. Hepatitis A can be fatal. He was hospitalized for 7 days at Kaiser. The lawsuit says that really all those damages were reasonably foreseeable on the part of Genki and Koha. By the way, no comment on the lawsuit from the two companies.
The man whose lawsuit we're talking about was also given the vaccine, wasn't he? But, and that
you know,
was before?
I don't know that, if that was the case. But you can read Louis Kinnea's story that's up on the site about this lawsuit. We do know this. The number of victims is likely to increase given the long incubation period for hepatitis A. So that is certainly of concern. A lot of people have been scrambling to get the vaccine. As you probably heard, the ramen store there at Don Quixote.
Right.
Yeah, near the HBR studios, right across the street, is the latest place identified. By the way, I am checking on Louis' story. He was given the vaccine after he experienced the symptoms.
But going back now to, you know, the fact that we have still this happening, and this certainly isn't over by any means. I mean, when we found out about the ramen store at Don Quixote, we were all sort of looking at each other like, and when did you go there last? But people are thinking about that wherever they've been, and certainly we may find that there will be many more cases of this popping up. This is certainly not over.
Right. Remember, Baskin-Robbins, Chili's, and Taco Bell previously identified a few other places as well, other food establishments. It's a growing list here on Oahu.
All right. We're going to see where that list goes and what happens here. There certainly may be other lawsuits in the making, too. Thanks very much, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat, and every day he joins us with a reality check.
Tonight at 5, Bethany will be bringing us Town Square, looking at the state of the environment 2016.
Yeah, you might remember that yesterday we started to talk about that just a little bit when Amy Hennessy was here from Ulupono Initiative. And tonight we're going to take it on and spend an hour looking at it in depth with three more members of the group. We're going to talk with Murray Clay, the managing partner of Ulupono Initiative, also Eric Koh, the senior program officer for marine conservation at the Herald Castle Foundation, and Josh Stanbro, Strategy Initiatives and Networks Director for Hawaii Community Foundation. We're going to look at freshwater security, community-based marine management, and renewable energy, the three focuses of this particular report, and some more of what came out of that, and what it means going forward as you're looking at a group of funders who are trying to position themselves as well as, you know, the work that's been done on the environment.
And I'm hoping there's some good news in among all this data.
Of course there's good news. I mean, there couldn't be a bunch of very bad news with all the work that's been done.
Yeah.
But what does that mean as you track that along with other areas where they're going to look at more closely next year and the following year, and to be able to integrate that well in pieces that, you know, people can easily bite off and understand? We're going to talk more about that and where it's going to go from here.
Yeah, it's getting it down to manageable levels is always the problem with something like this.
Very often that's true.
That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Bethany.
Had barely started when the parent company of Maui's HCNS sugar plantation, Alexander and Baldwin, announced it would close by year's end. 675 plantation employees would lose their jobs, and so might vendors who depend on HCNS. As to the land, the company said it was looking at a transition to diversified agriculture. During the legislative session, A&B also announced it would restore flow to some East Maui streams for taro farmers, just about the time a water rights bill moved into conference. The bill moved into law in June, allowing a holdover of current water lease permits while the final dispensation of the leases were pending. With 4 months left until the year does in fact end and HCNS closes, there are still many questions unanswered, and we asked A&B's CEO to join us to talk about some of them. Chris Benjamin is in our studio this morning. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
First of all, to the employees, some of them were already let go in March. Others continue to be let go, and it will complete by the end of the year. What's the status of their re-employment now? How many have been re-employed?
Well, you know, it's going pretty well. It's obviously one of the biggest concern we had when we made the announcement that we had to shut down the plantation was the transition for our employees. And so we've gone to great lengths to set up not only assistance with the actual transition. We have four transition coordinators who are working with our employees on outplacement, on finding new jobs, or facilitating their retirement if that's what they want to do. And we've also worked very closely with the union to ensure enhanced severance benefits. And so we're doing everything we can. But as you can imagine, trying to find new employment for almost 700 people is a challenge. We have so far laid off about 40% of the workforce, so just under a few hundred people. And about 100 of those have found, or just under 100, have found new jobs already. A number of them are still working with our transition coordinators, and a number of them have chosen to retire. So it's a work in progress, and our transition coordinator services will be available through next year, because we do recognize that it won't happen immediately. But a couple things that I think are working in our favor and the employees' favor is that, first of all, the economy is still pretty strong. And there is still a fair amount of demand for workers. And these are tremendous, tremendous people. They're hard workers, both skilled and unskilled. They have, the jobs they've had at HCNS have demanded a level of dedication that new employers are very happy to have and welcome into their workforce.
You're talking about field workers, but mechanics, scientists, administrative folks. I mean, not everybody is in one particular area. Some may have an easier job or time out finding a new job than others. When we talked to the Department of Labor earlier this year, they said they would be conducting a survey of the workers to assess skill sets and interests. Did you get any data back from that?
So what that is, Beth Ann, I believe that what you're referring to is the skills inventory that they do with each employee as they transition out of the company. And so that's an ongoing process. They have been working. In fact, today they will be meeting with a lot of our employees, because we have one of the next in a series of many job fairs that we've organized is happening today on Maui with several employers, I think dozens of employers today. And as part of that, the employees have the opportunity not only to meet with new employers, but to meet with the Maui Workforce Development Group, which is part of the state effort, and to sit down and go through a skills inventory to identify not only what they currently can do, but also what they might be interested in doing. And then I believe that group then tries to match that with employers who are looking for jobs. So I don't know that it's necessarily a survey from which we would get back broad results. I think it's really more at an individual level, trying to match their skills inventory with opportunities in the community.
But with your teams, who also have some of that data, that could be very helpful too.
Oh, yeah.
The data is used to apply for additional federal funds as well, but that's a separate issue.
Exactly.
So how much interface really is there with the Department of Labor and your transition teams?
Oh, there's quite a bit. Our transition coordinators are working regularly with a number of resources. It's not just the State Department of Labor, it's also the county. We've had a tremendous collaborative effort between the county, the state, and the federal government. Of course, as you're aware, our senators were instrumental in helping us get access to trade adjustment assistance for the employees. And so it's really been a very collaborative effort, and I think there's a lot of regular communication and coordination between these groups.
Do you have any sense of how many of these employees may or may not be able to stay on Maui that have to be relocated? I mean, there may be some funds available for that, federal funds available, but in terms of uprooting one's life and having to go elsewhere in pursuit of a job, that's not a new story for a lot of people, but particularly in a small community like Maui, that would be very difficult, I would
absolutely
imagine.
And that has been one of our biggest concerns. I would say that I am more encouraged today than I was hopeful on January 6th when we announced this, because of the success that a lot of our employees have had in finding new employment on Maui. Some have relocated, actually a fairly small number so far, and we've provided assistance with that. We're providing relocation assistance when it's necessary. But so far, I'm encouraged. I can't give you a percentage. I can't predict what the outcome might be. But I have been encouraged by the pace at which people have been finding new employment so far. And I should also point out that most of the early employees to be laid off are from our farming operation. They tend to be some of the lower skilled employees. I think that as we get later in the year and some of the more high skill employees are laid off, I think they may have even more success in finding work, but that remains to be seen.
But still, as you said a little earlier in the conversation, having now laid off a little under 40 or about 40% mm-hmm. of the workforce and approximately 100 people who have gotten jobs out of that, that's still a lot of people out of that almost 700 who are still going to be jobless, or as of the moment.
Right. I think it's a little early to project those percentages going forward. I do know that a lot of employees have chosen to take time, go back to the Philippines, for example, spend time with family, and then when they come back, they've asked to meet with the transition coordinator. So some of them are taking a break. So I don't know that we can necessarily say that out of the slightly less than 300 that have been laid off, only 100 have a job, so that means only a third. I think actually, if you look at those who have actively been looking for work, I think it's actually been a higher success rate.
So let's talk a little bit about the land. There's been a lot of speculation, and some driven by A and B is what you would do with all of this land. Has anything new surfaced in this idea of becoming, you know, diversified agriculture's, you know, best bet for Maui at the moment, beyond some of what we heard before, where it might be going to maybe some biofuel or maybe some small farms, or maybe there would be cattle grazing, you know, the same things that we've been talking about now for months. Has anything else beyond that surfaced in all these ensuing months that you've been looking at options?
Well, some new ideas have surfaced. I think the one thing that I want to start with is taking one thing off the table. I think there's been speculation that all of a sudden there's going to be a lot of new development on Maui because of this. None of these lands are going to be developed, probably in my lifetime. These are agricultural zone lands. These are lands that are, we have developments elsewhere on Maui. None of the development activity that we have in the foreseeable future is on land that is farmed by HCNS. So I just want to put that on the side and say that we are absolutely committed to trying to find agricultural uses for these lands, because that is the highest and best use. We have had tremendous outpouring of interest and support and inquiries from a wide range of parties that want to do different sorts of agriculture, some on 100 acres, some on 15,000 acres. It is quite a process of trying to sift through those things and figure out what has the most potential. There are some things that we're already doing. We're already fencing a lot of land for cattle pasture. We think that we can play a very positive role on Maui by supporting the existing cattle ranches, providing irrigated pastures where they can finish their cattle on island rather than shipping them to the mainland. We think it's a good thing for them. We think it's a good thing for the community. Other uses are still quite varied. There are a lot of the things that you mentioned. I guess if I had to give a short answer, which would be that it's too early to tell. There hasn't been a particular breakthrough or a particular solution that's emerged. But
no sense of we're going to be carving it up into X amount of parcels, or this is what size it would have to be for someone to be able to deal with it, that you're not going to be driven by the consumer, perhaps, but more.
Oh, I think we're going to be very driven by the consumer in the sense that we want to make whatever can work on Maui work. And I think one of the first things we're going to do is work with the county on an ag park where people could come in and get half acre, 5 acres, really, and work with the county on that so that people
will
have
those. Right, so there's no minimum size.
There's no minimum.
Got to move on with you a little bit. With what happened with the water rights bill, mm-hmm. with the fact that A and B said that you would be releasing water back into streams or certain streams in East Maui. What may happen with the land? What may happen with a lot of these employees? All of this goes back to what's the relationship now, or what is becoming the relationship between A and B and Maui? How do you characterize that, and how do you see that perhaps changing? Certainly the position of A and B has changed in no longer being the company that it was.
Well, I think that we are absolutely 100% committed to Maui, and I think this is a great opportunity for us. You know, one of the things about the plantation environment was that sugar plantations depended on scale. They depended on having as much land, as much water, as much throughput as possible. And that's why the last sugar plantation the plantation that survived the longest was the largest. It was HCNS. Now that we're moving out of that model, we have the ability to be a lot more flexible, a lot more diversified in the use of the land, do crop rotation, have better enhancement of soil, things that were not always possible given the very pressing need for high throughput in the sugar business. So I think we have an opportunity. And similarly, we have an opportunity to engage with the community and make sure that we're finding solutions that strike the right balance. And I'm actually very optimistic that more water will be going into the streams in the near term. I don't think we'll ever divert or need to divert as much water as we did in the past. And I think that if we can have these conversations and if we can engage with the community, it can actually end up being a very positive outcome for the island, even though I will always emphasize that it was a very sad decision that we had to make, and we do feel very strongly for our employees and want to make sure that they find good transitions.
Chris Benjamin, I wish we had more time to talk, but I know we plan to do that sometime in the very near future.
I look forward to
have you on Town Square. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Chris Benjamin is President and Chief Executive Officer of Alexander and Baldwin.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The Community Restoration Partnership funds near-shore habitat restoration and projects that improve coastal water quality. The main idea is to remove invasive species of plants and replace them with natives that will improve our water's ability to support life. This work is accomplished through community grassroots efforts. For example, a canoe club in Kailua took mangrove off the shoreline during their practice days because the root systems were causing the water to move so slowly that the oxygen rates fell too low. It was no longer a viable habitat for native fish. This statewide program is crucial because we have so much more to lose than other ecosystems. Hawaii is the endangered species capital of the world. Josh Stanbro from the Hawaii Community Foundation says,
we have 2% of the landmass of the U.S. and we have 25% of the threatened, endangered, extinct species.
So it's easily understood that this funding is absolutely necessary if we're to preserve Hawaii's near-shore habitats. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And now the answer to today's backyard quiz. We asked you to name a famous American photographer who's well known for his black and white photographs of the California coast and Yosemite National Park. Also, in his vast portfolio are lesser known images of Hawaii. His trademark style is evident whether you're looking at Monolith, which was taken in the High Sierras, or in the rainforest, photographed at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. He first visited the islands in 1948 via a Guggenheim Fellowship and was later commissioned in 1957 by the Bishop National Bank of Hawaii to document all the islands and its people. In 1964, he returned to the islands to publish a second volume of Hawaii photographs called An Introduction to Hawaii. He was Ansel Adams.
And Stan from Makiki knew the answer. Congratulations, Stan. You'll be getting an HPR t-shirt, and at 8:55, almost 8:56. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA FlexPlus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
On the next Radio Lab. Colors. When two people look at a rainbow,
do you see some of the pink in the blue?
Do they see the same thing?
See, I see a lot of pink. Like, do you see that?
No. All the Greeks were colorblind.
All of them were colorblind?
Yes. They saw the world in black and white, maybe with a touch of red.
Join us for Radio Lab
Saturday morning at 10.
Beth Ann, your discussion with Christopher Benjamin really looked at a whole changing way of life on Maui, didn't it?
And that's going to continue to change. And although we were able to have an extended conversation with him this morning, we're looking forward to sitting down with him for an hour. And he said he would make himself available to do that on the town square in the near future to talk about some of these issues that we were barely able to scratch this morning.
Well, there's just so much going on. And, of course, there are so many workers going to be displaced, and where do they go, right? That's always the issue in a case like
that. Where do they go? How is Maui changing that maybe will accommodate some of them or not? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen with all of that land? What will happen, you know, with the water? He mentioned not diverting as much water as they have in past. Clearly, earlier this year, we heard about the streams that will be getting water for taro farmers, but a lot of criticism about that still is swirling about all of this. This is not, you know, necessarily a done-down plan by any means.
Well, there's going to be plenty more to talk about.
You bet.
Sure.
And we'll plan to do that right here.
And tomorrow, we're going to have a polo ambassador from the Punjab who's coming to Hawaii.
In the meantime, if you would like to respond to anything that you hear on Hawaii Public Radio's The Conversation, you can do that by calling our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find past shows on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics under Talk Shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkut.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.